Today is September the 15th, 1977, and my name's James Murphy, and I'm talking with Mr. E.M. Johnson, who served with the Intelligence Corps in World War II, the Canadian Intelligence Corps. Mr. Johnson, could you give us a brief rundown on your family background?
Certainly, Ruby. I was born on a farm in Saskatchewan, and I moved to British Columbia and Victoria in particular in the early 20s. I was educated here, and I went to Malaya in the 1930s. I arrived in Malaya in 1936. While I was on Vancouver Island, of course, we lived at Chosen, and I left for the Orient from Victoria.
In 1936.
In 1936.
So your first association with the military life was with the Canadian Scottish Regiment here in Victoria?
Yes, that is correct. I joined the 2nd Battalion, 16th Scottish, out at Colwood. Colonel Babty was recruiting locally for the battalion, and he created there the particular company out at Colwood and Happy Valley, and I believe at that time a chap by name of Georgeson was the lieutenant in charge of our particular unit. But he's really the only one that comes to mind. I cannot even remember at this time who were my fellow sufferers in the militia.
Where was the hall? Where did you meet out in Caulfield? Or Colwood, rather?
Well, actually, we didn't meet at Colwood. We met in Happy Valley at a fellow's farm, a chap named Brown, who we used to use his farmyard as our parade ground. We only met very occasionally at the old Colwood Community Hall. We seldom, if ever, were marched into Victoria to the old marched the armories. The only once or twice that this happened, we were supposed to have been picked up by truck. The trucks never arrived, and as they say, they marched us into Victoria footsore with one piper, equally dry as ourselves, and all of us extremely tired and disgruntled. I think it was very shortly after that time that I ceased to operate as a member of the 16th Scottish, because I was going back to school anyway.
What were the conditions, especially a 2nd Battalion and a Reserve Regiment? There wasn't a lot to money to go around. What was it like as far as that?
Well, we didn't receive any pay for the works which we did. We were fortunate to receive uniforms, complete uniforms and arms. Occasionally when we went on one or two day reconnaissance or schemes, which we did from time to time at the head of Whitty's Lagoon and that area. In those days, the way through to Whitty's Lagoon wasn't through the Whitty place so much as it was through the home of Major Meredith Jones on the Albert Head Road. And I distinctly remember that's how we went up and through. We invaded the Whitney Griffith place, much to his surprise and annoyance, and disturbed his animals and all the rest with our guns and running. We had quite a lot of good fun at that time, but as you can well realize, it was very, very much, as far as strategy was concerned, not based on any newer strategy or any strategy that might be related to later jungle or guerrilla tactics which we came to know during and after the Second World War. It was very much based on the idea of what had been done on First World War tactics.
We don't. In 1937, when you went to Malaya to work for Dunlop Rubber, you joined the Malacca Volunteers as a private. What was your motivation in doing this? Did you expect a war? Or?
No, that wasn't part of the motivation. The motivation there is this, that the country then as now was very unhealthy, and the average Caucasian that went there, despite anything he might do, was going to be the victim of either dengue or malaria or dysentery or any of those diseases which are inherent in the tropics, and particularly at that time. And in order to defray your part of your hospital expenses or any of your recuperative expenses, the companies insisted that you belong to a militia unit, because the militia unit paid half and the company paid half, or the militia unit paid half and the government paid half if you were in government service. That was the whole motivation.
Was this then a prevalent practice amongst white people in Malaya?
It was a prevalent practice amongst white people, Chinese and Malays and Indians.
Wow.
Wherever employed and wherever it applied. There was, of course, don't forget, in all these battalions and all these volunteer corps, as they were called, there were white units, Indian units, Chinese units, and Malay units, all mixed together.
Do you mean in a company would be racially mixed then?
Sometimes, this is quite likely to happen. They didn't really mix the Chinese and the Malays. They might mix us up with the Chinese, or they might mix us up with the Malays, or they may put them as units together. But they were rather careful because of the friction, even then, existing friction between the Chinese and the Malays, not to cause any friction by having, Malayan sergeant in charge of Chinese privates. But this, a little diplomacy was required here and there. The same with the Indian peoples, or the Portuguese burghers of Malacca. When I mean Portuguese burghers, I mean those people of mixed Portuguese and Dutch and Malayan and or Indian blood. Mm-hmm. That had existed in Malacca for hundreds of years. These are the people that you depended on a great deal to support your local community efforts and your volunteer corps as well.
Did the fact that a lot of people were in the volunteers for basically medical reasons, did you notice that would make a difference on a sort of esprit de corps?
No, I didn't. I usually found the esprit de corps and the volunteers corps extremely good, because although you might be segregated when you were out on the parade ground, you sure as hell were not segregated when it came round to the mess. Because you see, there was a mess, which was a composite mess. There was an officer's mess off to one side, and whether you were a white officer or a Chinese officer, a Malay officer or Indian officer, that's where you were. And then there was the other ranks and sergeants' messes, and there you were more or less mixed together. Sergeants in their mess and the rest of us poor souls in the main, big mess, which was really a big club room.
I see.
It wasn't, you have to think of these things in the terms, in the context in which you find them. For instance, there was some, you've got some segregation of peoples. Particularly in the white units. For instance, in the white units in the volunteer corps, X, who may come out as a junior planter to the Dunlops, for instance, might be a member of the Artists' Rifles in London. He might be a lieutenant in the Artists' Rifles in London. He then carried his commission with him out to Malaya. And his boss on the plantation, being a member of the volunteers, might be a corporal in charge of latrines. Mm-hmm. And so, no matter what, the chap having the commission, held his commission, was a commissioned officer in the Volunteers, and at that point in time, when on parade and during any of the exercises, the boss of the plantation was
his subordinate.
It was his subordinate.
What about the exercises? What I meant by the esprit de corps, were they able to demand very difficult, time-consuming things if this was...
No. They weren't. They didn't, in fact. There was certainly a good deal of rivalry between the machine gun units on the ranges. You know, the Caucasian units vis-a-vis the Chinese unit, vis-a-vis the Malay unit, vis-a-vis the Indian unit, all on the same vickers. Who had the best setup, who had the quickest, who could put the five shots into the pan the quickest,
right,
or into the target the quickest. In that way, there was a certain amount of rivalry, certainly a great deal of esprit de corps.
As far as the vast majority, it wasn't the same as, say, the militia in Canada, where people were being in the militia almost in spite of things rather than...
No. You know what I was going to say after that talk? I'm sorry I digressed to a speaking call. I just wanted to point that, I wanted to bring that up to the point. The point is that what we were taught when we went on our two-week course in at Tanjung Badara, outside Malacca, was in no way related to the type of fighting we would do later. We had no jungle training whatsoever.
Yes, sir.
We just did the old form free, as though we'd be marching down the road to meet whoever our enemy might be. And dear me, as for going into the jungle or trying to fight on the hillsides as guerrilla units or any of that sort of thing, we never had it at all. It was talked about. It was particularly talked about just before the invasion, but of course nothing was ever done about it.
What sort of war did they expect in 1938 down in Malaya? They
expected, of course, the war in Malaya wasn't really expected. Now let's face the issue very squarely. There was expected to be a incursion perhaps at Singapore, trying to sink Singapore, as we used to say, but then of course they had the big guns pointing out to sea, therefore they would never come. I don't think that anybody really dreamed that they'd come down via Siam and French Indochina and Kuantan and the various places at which they did.
So they didn't expect a land war in Southeast Asia?
No. They expected it might be a little bit of an air war and a little bit of a naval war, but of course, I think the reason for that was that nobody really thought that the jungles would be worth fighting. In other words, good Lord, the Japs can't survive in the jungle. A whole lot of fables were brought in and tenderly nourished until the reality came along and we were all going like hell backwards down the peninsula.
When the reality finally did come along, you were with another unit by then, or were you?
Yes, now I had come home to Canada, and at that time when I came home to Canada, I tried to get back into the 16th Scottish, which were then out at Corwood. And I went to see Baptie and suggested to Colonel Baptie that he was missing a good officer by not having me with his unit, to which he told me to go to pot, because I was out in Malaya planting rubber. Rubber was needed, they didn't need the soldiers. And therefore, he certainly would not encourage me to remain. I was to go back to Malaya, which of course I did. When I went back to Malaya, which was later in the fall, I'd been back about a month and a half up in Pahang. And there I belonged to the Pahang Volunteers, who had their headquarters in Temerloh.
And you... these place names, anyway. Bahangza's
province. Bahang is a big province, right. And it borders on the northeastern border of the Malayan Peninsula, and it is that province, and north of that province, that the Japanese invaded when they invaded on the night, on the evenings or the night of December the 7th.
And you were in the front lines, so to speak?
Yes, we had got orders, I think, about 48 hours before to report. I was on plantation doing my usual work when a runner came with the word that I was, we all to report immediately to Temelo and to get be armed and ready to go up north, up onto the Kwantan River, pardon me, on the Pahang River, and to the mouth. And we went straight up through there. They marched us for about 8 hours from a point. There was some confusion. Let me say this right from the beginning, that confusion was rife. let's understand this, that things didn't go smoothly, and please understand that no matter how many films on war you may see, or how many American dramas you may incur, war, whether you begin it or when you organize it, is a state of confusion. And believe me, the Malaya mobilization was no exception to this. The confusion was that we were let off at the wrong point for our pillboxes, and we were supposed to be right up on close to the coast at the mouth of the river, and we were let off about, 10 or 15 miles back of that, to another point, so that when we had to march up and get into our positions, which were pillboxes, which weren't complete, or anything, and then our cooking materials and our supplies followed later in the day. We got ourselves in, we got our machine guns mounted in the pillboxes, and we set up our targets and laid our guns and waited for what was going to happen, which we all suggested wasn't going to happen at all anyway.
That was that the Japanese would actually show up.
That they'd ever show up, or that they were anywhere near where we were. We didn't even know it, you know. We knew something was wrong, but nobody would tell us anything, and nobody really knew anything, I'm sure, where they actually were going to land. And as you know, they landed right on top of us. They landed on the west side of the river in two landings at least, and there was a third landing on the east side of the river. We were located on the west side of the delta, and the line broke behind us, and the Japanese swung past us, apparently. We barely used our guns at all. In fact, we'd only just started to use our guns on what we thought was enemy craft coming through, but it turned out to be a patrol boat whipping down the river in part of the retreat. We then got word to break out fast and go, and we just simply took our guns over to a truck which was waiting for us, and we haired out of there like a bat out of hell, and subsequently blew the small bridge behind us and continued on down,
proceeding south,
down the peninsula.
Right. And so it wasn't a successful engagement then. You were surrounded almost instantly by...
Yeah, we were outflanked, right. And apparently somebody had enough sense to get us out before we were surrounded.
Where did you retire to?
We retired to a small town at the railhead, what was then the railhead, which the name of which I can't remember right off the bat. I would have to look into the history of the thing and let you know that. We were then broken up, and I was sent over with the Garhwali engineers, and our job then was to continue on down the peninsula south along the railhead and blow up the bridges as we went. And this we did right through to Kwantan on the west coast. And as you know, the Japs took Kuantan and our guns, and within very short notice. From there, we again kept going southward, blowing up bridges as we went, sometimes being strafed by Zero fighters, sometimes being harried every now and again by the occasional bit of mortar fire, which I think was more random than directed. But we were always the last troop out. And this went on right down until, I got to a junction down in Johor.
How did, during the retreat, did the Malayan forces manage to maintain their supplies and that sort of thing, or did things just sort of fall apart?
No, a matter of fact, supplies were remarkably well kept up. I thought the question you were going to ask us was, did the Chinese and the Malay volunteer parts of our unit stay with us? The answer is no. That after we left the railhead, there was a point in time, just south of Kuala Lumpur, when we knew what the score was going to be, and we advised all our Malay people types to take off their uniforms and return to their native costume, and revised all our Chinese people to remove their uniforms and go back to slacks and trousers and get back to their homes as quickly as possible, because the Japanese were obviously countering all our moves by land and by sea and by air.
Uh-huh.
There was no, in the minds of most of us, there was no doubt about that.
Well, the outcome,
things were the outcome. Yeah. It was pretty, at least in that particular area, we had no doubt about the outcome, because they'd outflanked us by sea, they'd knocked out all our air force, we'd heard about the sinking of the Repulse and the Prince of Wales, and we knew that we'd, you know, that it was just a matter of time, we'd have to retreat back to some place we thought, near Port Swettenham, or around in there, where we would perhaps make a stand. We weren't sure. Will you chop this for one moment? After we had disbanded the Asian part of our troop, we continued on down the railway through Kuala Lumpur to Seremban, to Tampin, and on south. We outflanked Malacca, we didn't go near there. We went right through to a particular junction which was due west of the port of Moore. As you know, one of the outstanding pieces of parts of the defeat was the Battle of Moore. This is where Australian troops, British troops, Indian troops, and the whole lot were driven back in a rather outstanding defeat because of the particular strategy of the Japanese, who had been using sea flanking movements, and of course also were using land flanking movements. This took place in late January, and I had then left the Garhwali engineers, and I was seconded over to the Black Watch, 2nd Battalion, who were manning the road block and had the 25-pounder artillery at the junction. And I can't remember exactly what I was doing when I was seconded there, but anyway, I was put up to dispatch riding. I was by then a sergeant. I had sort of come up step by step by attrition. There were no more sergeants left, shall we say, and certainly I was not sergeant of anything in particular. I was just a man on his own who happened to hold that rank at that particular time. And there was really nothing for me to do as an individual, and indeed the Black Watch 2nd Battalion didn't know what to do with me. And I would have done, been quite happy to have been done with them and been on my way to Singapore, where I understood that apart from the junction where we were then located, which would be just before everybody moved out, it would be at that time, we were located there, and we were being shelled there, and we were being bombed there, and it was a very uncomfortable period. And again, we remained there with the 25-pounders as all the troops out of Moore and elsewhere withdrew back beyond us. That would be even including the East Surreys and the Sherwood Foresters and the rest. All went back.
Approximately how large was the contingent at Moore?
Oh, no more than a couple of companies and maybe 6 or 8 guns.
That was the rear guard that...
Yeah. It was partly a supply unit and partly an artillery unit. We knew that we were for it. Immediately the guns were withdrawn, and then within about 6 hours of that, we were withdrawn. And we were withdrawn then right down past Johor Bahru, across the
Trincomalee.
We're then withdrawn right through down past the causeway, right into Singapore itself. And at that point, we were given a very short rest down on the Kallang, down in the Kallang area of Singapore Island. And at that time, I began to look for such remnants of my own units that might be left. Found very, very few of them indeed. And we were then organized into the remnants of the Singapore Volunteer Corps.
And by this, what date are we looking at?
We're now looking at the end of... We're now looking at, pardon me, I'm slightly out in my dates, I think, because there's one point in time that we spent, I know I spent New Year's Eve in a foxhole. And it would appear to be sometime in January. We're still looking at January. We were quite a long period of time down in the island of Singapore itself. All the time that we were there, the process on the mainland was disintegrating. The works of demolition were going on. We could hear it. We heard the time that the causeway was blown up, that sort of thing. We were shifted round to various positions on the island, and everywhere we went on the island, you had all the signs of places being abandoned.
So there was a general air of defeatism.
There was a general air of... I won't call it defeatism exactly, but the impression on the individual when you went to look at these places was one of question as to what was indeed going on, and what if these people were all being withdrawn, for instance, the naval units being withdrawn, the Air Force being withdrawn, you'd be asking, why in the hell haven't we been withdrawn? You know, what's going on here? Why are we left? And only, I would say, in the latter week was there an air of defeat.
That was the last, week in February.
Somewhere between the 7th and the 14th for me. Now, I had been under ever-increasing bombing stress. Rations were getting less and less. Water was getting hard to get. We were constantly being shifted from point A to point B. This, I think, was the most devastating effect of the lot, was the constant shift. You never knew where you were going to be from one day's end to the next. And you were always being moved. You're being moved because somebody wanted this unit over here to do something. You'd get there, and they would move you again because the situation had changed. And this was so from the day that the Japanese came across to the island in the Causeway area through to, as far as I know, to the day of defeat on the 15th of February. The final day, which I am going to tell you, is the final 48 hours, I think, as far as I'm concerned, is one of the few clear areas in my mind now. Because at that time, we were standing guard along a canal, a small canal which ran along through the Kallang Aerodrome, as a matter of fact. We were coming back to this Kallang area. And there was firing and there was smoke and bomb fires, because they were burning in the north. They were burning all the areas over on the eastern sides of the island and all that sort of thing. There was a great deal of noise and confusion and constant, but in fact, Japs were over quite regularly. They bombed everybody and everything with great regularity. We had just got our guns set up along this small canal, and during the daylight hours, you could see the wreckage of our planes and all this sort of thing, a very bleak outlook. People were all looking very quietly at you and very hang-dog at you, and there was a distinct feeling of removal, a sort of departure. There was the feeling of reality had gone. We knew something was in transition, and we knew it was defeat that was coming upon us. The final 48 hours, I was suddenly called away from my guns and taken to the YMCA. I wasn't told for why I was taken to the YMCA. Everything went on much as it always had, the bombs, the shells, the noise, and so forth. Finally, I was called out and told that I was part of an escape party. This was the next day. And that we'd be leaving officially that night, and I should be prepared to go. And we left on 10 o'clock on the 14th. I believe the name of the party to whom the escape was carried out was a Brigadier Parish or Paris. I've never been able to quite clear this as to the name. I think he had something to do with the fortress. I'm not sure that he wasn't the Brigadier in charge of the fortress engineers. But anyway, we took them all out. There was about 30 of us or less as an official escape party that went across from the harbour out over the minefields past Pulu Ubin. Now Pulu Ubin is the old oil island where all the oil was kept. It was burning, full blast. They had blown up the oil dumps, everything like that. And we went due south over the minefield, out into the darkness and blackness, on what kind of course, I've no idea. We arrived at a place called Zweibrodde Islands the next day, and I think the next evening, if time serves me right, we arrived at Jambi on the Sumatran coast. From there we went overland, up through to a place I believe called Muratumbisi, which is on the opposite coast. We went up one of these very precipitous railways and down again. It was burning, and we stole a ship there, coal ship, and we went down through the Java Straits and into the port of Chilapjack in Java. And if you ever come across the Battle of the Java Sea, you will hear mention of the town of Chilapjack, which was the last place where the Allied forces had their port to for their sallies out to try and defeat the Japanese forces, naval forces. Of course, they never did this. They were chopped up piecemeal, sunk.
Through this peregrinations, were the Japanese hot on your heels or in the
general? No, I can't recall that at that point in time the Japanese were apparently busy elsewhere, because we seem to have missed them all the time, including going through the Sunda Strait. I don't know how we got there. I'll be quite truthful with you. We took this old coal boat and we fired her up, and she had on, we got on board half a dozen cases of canned herring and a few bags of rice, and we went quietly on our way down the coast by day and by night till we got to Lapjam. And we put her alongside the quay in Chilakjam. And from there, I got on board the old Zandam, which was a big passenger liner of the Silver Java line. She was diesel. She went out, and I don't know the day she went out, but she left port. And she left port with two destroyers and a freighter. And we made our way then down to Fremantle in Australia. And believe me, that's a not to be forgotten voyage. Because then, of course, the Japanese had command of the air and the sea. And of all, the only one to get to Fremantle was the Zander. The freighter was sunk, the two destroyers turned away, and they were subsequently sunk. And we just opened up the ruddy engines and went like a bat out of hell down to Port Swetman, down to Fremantle.
Why do you think that you were picked for this escape party? Any luck of the draw? In other words, there was no general criteria?
I don't know of any criteria that would say that I was one of the escape party that was to go. I honestly don't know.
Did this escape party have a purpose other than the obvious?
No, the escape party was made up to escort some senior brass out of the fortress, I think.
Including Brigadier General?
Yeah, whatever, Harris. I don't think it was a brigadier. I don't think it was a brigadier general. He was just a brigadier type. A number of red tabs with him. I don't recall who they were now, but we did get through to Australia. We did try to reorganize ourselves there, but we were disbanded forthwith and shifted out into the Australian units. About that time I demanded that I be returned to Canada.
And when you returned to Canada, you tried to enlist, and they...
Oh, yes, when I returned to Canada, it was all very funny. I returned to Canada and reported into Work Point Barracks. That's the first thing I did. I landed from the ship from San Francisco, and my wife drove me down to the Work Point Barracks. Having got my wife to drive me down, I went in to see one of the officers whom I knew, or my dad knew, and said, "Here I am. What do I do now?" And they said, "Oh, one moment. Intelligence would like to see you right away." So there was an intelligence officer, who shall be nameless at this time, who said to me, "Very good, Sergeant Johnson. Would you mind just taking this pad and piece of paper and just write out the whole thing as it goes?" So I wrote it out, and I said, where may I get back into the Canadian Army?" He said, "No way are you getting back into the Canadian Army." He said, "I just want to tell you that we've just had word on all of you who escaped out of Singapore are to be charged with deserting your posts." And I said, My goodness, I mean, you can understand, I was not at all happy at this. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, one moment, look, here's my pay book. And in it is a letter from, I forget the name of the letter, tenants or signed by one, saying that I'm a member of an official skate party. And however, that they would confirm all this with Whitehall. In the meantime, I would be allowed to return to my home, or the hospital, whichever was required, which I did. And subsequent to that, I remained at home for quite some period while they were making up their mind exactly what my status was. The end of it all was that A, I was not a deserter, B, I was the member of an official skate party, C, as soon as I was well enough, I was to be inducted into the Canadian Forces.
As a...
private.
As a private.
Now, I want you to know that, yes, as a private, definitely. At that point in time, I became a recruit again. And as a recruit, I was sent up to Vernon to take basic training, which, I, as far as I'm concerned, was the final insult. But not only was I deprived of all rank that I enjoyed for even for a short period, but I was probably then, at that point in time, which is May, June, July of 1942, 43, I can't remember offhand, about the only Canadian with some frontline experience in the Second World War. And naturally this gave me what I consider to be a little edge on the rest. But nevertheless, I had to go through basic training all over again. While I was at basic training, the word came through that I was to report to Vancouver forthwith. And I was then inducted into the Japanese language school.
Which was at Vancouver?
Yep, S20 Japanese language school. And there, I spent pretty near the rest of the war until I was sent back into India, Burma, and Malaya. That's really the whole story.
Well,
I became a member of Force 136 in India.
Right.
And I was a member at that point. Somewhere in there, at the time of the date that I was recruited into the Canadian Army, and inducted into the Japanese language school, I became a member of the Canadian Intelligence Corps. At some point further on in my training, I was attached to Force 136, which was the military arm of, I believe, the Ministry of Economic Warfare, and as such I went out to India and Burma and Malaya as a Canadian officer.
You were first landed in India?
Yeah.
And as a practice, a dry run sort of thing?
No, I think they landed us in India because that's where you started everything from. We started, for instance, from, we started out at Bombay. They loaded us off in Bombay and said, right, you're going to take jungle tactics down in Pune. And in Pune, we literally went into the jungle and began to be jungle fighters. At that point, fortunately for me, I got very, very ill with some form of glandular fever. I was always coming up with these things anyway. They're very useful for not getting too involved in any further training or doing anything very exciting. But in this case, it was particularly useful because I had been doing, you know, the training was pretty damned hard, and I'd been going pretty damned hard myself when half of the intelligence officers which were with me decided they'd had enough of training. They didn't want to have any more training of any kind whatsoever. They wanted to take part in the fighting or something. I've been quite sure of the beginnings of all this thing. But anyway, it was in effect a mutiny, a Canadian mutiny at Pune in the jungle camp. And when that had a just complete refusal to obey orders. Now it just happened that the colonel in charge of the camp knew about me and my previous experience in the Far East, and I'll never know to this day how or why he laid the blame for the mutiny on me. Whereas I had been, actually, when the mutiny was going on, if you want to call it that, they just told the sergeant in charge to go to park. They weren't going to go out on these exercises anymore. They'd been spending all their time out in the areas near Kamloops and up near Prince Rupert in what they considered to be jungle fighting for the last 2.5 years themselves, some of them. They said, right, what the hell is the good of us doing more?
Right.
I mean, it was completely unjustified, let me assure you, because jungle fighting is absolutely different. It is guerrilla warfare, true, but it's entirely different from anything you get locally in BC. But they were too damn dumb not to realize that, I guess. But anyway, when they were busy setting up their mutinous times and so forth and so on, and refusing to obey orders and doing this, I was neatly down in my pack and in my sleeping bag, running a temperature of 103. Taking no part whatsoever. In fact, I had to be carried out, and I was carried out and dumped in front of the colonel while I could still stand, while he belabored me for having allowed this thing to happen. And God, it's truth. I was a mere lieutenant at that time. True, my third pip was on its way. I didn't know it. And there was a captain ahead of me who'd been rather more instrumental than some in having this thing go forward. And so I just said nothing. There was nothing I could say. What do you say to that sort of thing? It's no good denying that you have had some part in it, otherwise you're going to get somebody else into trouble. So I just kept mum. And about an hour later, when they discovered I was really damned ill, the thing was cleaned up, cleared off. But I can always remember the colonel to this day. This was about 2 days later, when I'd been filled with atabrin and filled with all kinds of then antibiotics. Sulfurates, whatever they were doing, saying, well, sorry about, putting essential blame on you, but as far as I'm concerned, you are the only officer which had any experience in the Far East that has done any fighting in the jungle. Why did you not take some steps to discourage it? This was his belief, apparently. I never knew it. And you know, strange to relate, that damn report followed me all the way down through to Singapore, to the very day that I took off from Singapore on board the USS Tennessee, some months later. But anyway, from India we went down through